My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
Well, we go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, can you give me the meaning of the following words? Dennis Powell, hallelujah.
Well, it means hooray.
It means derivatively hooray, but you're not helping me terribly much so far. I want to know it a bit more literally than that.
Well, it means hooray in biblical terms.
Yes, very biblical terms.
It means sort of praise the Lord.
Well, look, 2 marks it is. It's a Hebrew hallelujah, which means praise ye Jehovah or Jah or Jahweh. And you find it in many psalms and anthems and normally now a song of praise to God. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, charisma.
Oh, yes. One of the vogue words, and you use it and nobody quite knows, but we all agree that we... I mean, the first time I heard it, it sounds like a Mexican swear word, actually. Remember in boys' books, Mexicans used to say sapristi, which they never say anymore, but in a man, it's a kind of undefined, possibly because it's indefinable, spiritual sort of aura that marks him out as a leader, the kind of men who wind up either as sort of tycoons or in vodka commercials.
I think that's very good indeed, Dennis.
Not in television set commercials.
It's a free gift or talent, and as Dennis quite rightly said, originally it was a spiritual gift, and it can be used more loosely to mean flair or charm or ambience, any of those words. Curiously, it was used as charism first, I think, in 1641, so though it's become a vogue word, it goes back into English history. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, egregious.
Well, I've always called that egregious, but I expect I'm wrong.
It has an I after the G, and therefore it has to be soft.
I suppose it's soft. All right. Well, Grex is Latin for a flock.
Yes.
So it means one who is singled out from the flock.
Well done.
And is therefore exceptional.
It can be an exceptional outstanding out of the ordinary and so on. It's got a good and a bad meaning, in other words. 2 marks. Frank Miller, spatterdash. S-P-A-T-T-E-R.
Spatterdash.
No, spat. Spatterdash. D-A-S-H.
If you take snuff in a car when you're driving... I seem to have said enough there, yeah. Didn't I? The tendency to over-shove up. And it's the condition of the instrument panel of my car.
Yes, this is a very good clue, Frank, but...
It's the answer. What do you mean, a clue?
In this case, you're the sufferer rather than the agent.
Oh.
Mud.
Anyone
mud
who is the victim of mud.
Yes, and...
It's spatterdash.
Yes, but look at the word again and put it as shortly as you can, leaving out the 2 last syllables.
Spatterdash.
Ter?
No, no.
Ter.
I'm sorry, and we'll leave out the last two syllables.
I stabbed, is all I
can.
Leave out the last.
Spats. Spats. A round of applause for getting it without you.
I don't know. I'm going to give you one. A spatterdash was a long gaiter of cloth, usually, worn to protect the stockings or trousers from mud splashes, particularly when you were riding. So that the word known more today as spats derives from spatterdashes, but they're virtually sawn-off spatterdashes, only going that far up and not right up to the knee. One is a fairly generous mark. Well, at this point, I give Frank and Dennis a quotation to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is, goodbye, Mr. Chips. And for you, Dennis, A time to be born and a time to die. And the second round is a round of unconventional definitions. These are fairly highly personalized definitions by well-known writers for 2 marks of what is the following a definition and who so defined him, her, or it. We begin with Dennis Powell. He is commonly a wretch who supports with insolence and is paid with flattery.
18th century?
Yes.
18th century. Now, Johnson.
Yes, Johnson.
Johnson.
And what's he talking about? Who is he talking about?
Who is he talking about? Johnson. Who's Johnson talking about? A patron.
And why?
Ah.
Johnson has a peculiar hatred against patrons. Mm. The reason is his patrons were insolent,
yes,
to the poets that they gave their patronage to, and all dedications to patrons were the most abysmal, crawling examples of flattery.
Yeah. 2 marks. What the heck? Now, Dennis Norton, it is the one ultimate and sacred thing which cannot be criticized. Our relations with it are direct and even divine relations. And it's very much in your line of country, Dennis.
I was going to say sex. And in fact, I will. you having given me that clue.
No, it would relate much more to scriptwriters than
it does. Something to do with comedy or drama or
theatre.
Yes,
stick to that.
Comedy.
Yes, well, now refine that a little closer and I'll give you a mark.
A joke or a...
Well done. We got it.
And who do you think might have uttered this?
I don't know. Sorry, I did. It's rather ponderous.
Yeah. It's not sufficient.
But everybody who writes about jokes tends to be
yes,
ponderous, except Paul Jennings.
Yes.
I really don't know, because I don't know anybody who hasn't been ponderous when writing, but there's so many people. You could say Max Eastman or...
He was a specialist in paradox, but this isn't a paradox. It doesn't help very much.
Just divine. Is it Chesterton?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it makes marking very difficult. I had to give a certain amount of help.
What you're paid for, Jack.
Yes, but I always get it wrong all the same. 1.5. And that's a fairly good mark, I think. Now, Anne Scott James... It is the extreme form of censorship.
Assassination.
Well done. Assassination is the extreme form of censorship, that's right. And who wrote it?
Isn't it... I could be absolutely wrong on this. In one of Shaw's prefaces.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. A thing called The Rejected Statement. It's George Bernard Shaw, and assassination is the extreme form of censorship. 2 marks. Frank Muir. It is a pistol let off at the ear, not a feather to tickle the intellect.
When Dennis and I assembled the book of the My Word stories, we were trying to find quotations against puns.
Yes.
But this is a quotation for puns.
Yes.
Charles Lamb.
Quite right. Well done. 2 marks. Next round is about origins and derivations, and this is a team effort, which means they can sort of cheat publicly instead of cheating privately. I want to know, for 2 marks, how the following words or phrases originated or were derived. We begin again with Phyllis Powell and Frank Muir, and yours is a bean feast.
Good blowout, actually.
Yeah, good blowout.
Need I say more?
Yes, who is giving it?
Hence a beano.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm. But who originally
described
gave this?
Described by Lord Curzon as a Biano.
Yes, he did. Yes. Quite right.
It was Pythagoras, the sage of Samos.
None of that is right.
He said abstain from beans.
Yes, he did. Yes.
The other way around.
But it is a particular kind of feast. I mean, you've got the essence of it right.
Dangerous.
A particular kind of bird, which was called a bean something or other.
Bean bird.
Old beans. There's a feast and joy by the old beans.
And there were pink-footed ones and Brent ones and other things.
Bean shoveler.
Doing our best to help.
Bean catcher.
Waste goose.
Bean catch oyster.
That's it.
You can catch beans.
If you listen to Anne, you're getting there.
Waste goose.
Yes.
A waste goose.
A waste goose.
Now, what was that?
Printer's annual feast.
Yes.
And who paid?
The employers.
That's
paid.
What I wanted.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to give you one out of two. A feast given by an employer to those he employs, and as Frank said, much the same as a waste goose, which was what happened in printing houses, but the employers paid. And originally, one theory at any rate is that the food was a bean goose, which is a particular kind of goose, has a funny kind of beak, which looks like a bean or a bit of it. It may be that beans were also served as vegetables, and Eric Partridge, who is no mean authority, says that tailors, as early as 1890, applied a bean feast to any good meal.
Bean Partridge.
Anyway, one, I think. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, yours is a lotus eater, and you can spell that either L-O-T-O-S or L-O-T-U-S.
Well, the island of Gerba, or it is now thought to be, the original lotus island of the Odyssey, isn't this right?
Yes, and what did they do there?
And they did absolutely nothing. It was a land where it was always afternoon.
Always afternoon.
And all they did was lotuses.
Why?
Well, to keep them sleepy and dopey. And
it's better than beans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tennyson.
Yes, sir.
That's where
the melancholy,
land.
Mild-eyed lotus eaters came.
Yes, we're there. That's where the
and
land
the great
was always
thing
afternoon.
When Odysseus got there was to prevent him and his chap and his crew from eating the lotus and thereby never getting home to Ithaca.
Absolutely right. That's a very, very splendid summary of that bit of the Odyssey and also of Tennyson's poem. And the lotus tree was apparently a North African shrub, or some people think that, which had been identified with the jujube tree, which I think is rather nice. And if you ate it, you became forgetful of your home and where you'd come from and of everything except lolling about and having a lovely time. And that's the modern use of lotus eaters, usually abroad, living very expensively but not doing very much. Well, now we come to the last round. And we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the programme. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Frank, your quotation is, "Goodbye, Mr. Chips."
I was strolling the other day, just strolling, and I was on my own. Usually, if I'm strolling, it's me and somebody else, but I wasn't meandering. I was just strolling. It was through Buckingham Palace Mews. I was just musing as I was walking. And I remember reaching the round pond, just pondering. And I went and had a hot tea at that round tea shop there in Kensington Gardens. And I remember exactly what I had. I had a hot fritter. And I had some 4 waffles with Canadian maple syrup on them. And I was very lonely and sort of sad about myself at the time. It's quite recently, actually. And I thought, this is how I'm spending my life. I'm frittering away my life. Just waffling on radio programs. And I'm not achieving anything. You know, if I could have been a dancer like Fred Astaire if I'd had the teeth. I could have been a singer like Tom Jones if I'd had the trousers. I would always seem to be... I could have spent most of my working life working opposite somebody interesting like Frank Muir. But I was born the wrong one. And spent my working life working opposite Dennis Norden. I just seem to have sort of failed somehow. Everything I do is ephemeral. It's not going to last. And I was thinking this, and suddenly the lady opposite me was fanning her cocoa with the Evening Standard, and I saw that, I noticed that at Sotheby's there was a little terracotta head of Madame Gautier had been sold at Sotheby's for £14,000. And of course, I realised then that's where immortality lies. That's where you get passed down to posterity. A terracotta head. If somehow I could have a terracotta head of myself, it rises in value, as you think from our rotten scripts, which are worthless the following morning. It rises in value, and nobody would have heard of Madame Gautier if it hadn't been of Rodin's terracotta head of her. So I thought, what I'll do is, I will sculpt a terracotta head of myself and present it to the National Portrait Gallery. Well, they can't refuse, you see. And it'll say then languish in about 100 years' time. I'll be famous twice, as the sculptor and as the head. You see, I mean, it couldn't fail, could it? One would have thought. So, you know, there's no difficulty in the actual sculpting thing. I took a series of photographs of myself, 36 actually, sort of all the way round. I did this by going up the Post Office Tower restaurant on a slack afternoon. As you know, it revolves. And I ended up with 36 enlargements of my own dear head all the way round. So couldn't fail. Terracotta was a bit of a worry. I didn't really know what it meant. I thought it was one of those particularly heavy-handed children's nurse. But I discovered it's a kind of rather beautiful browny red clay. So I dug some up in the garden and mixed it with boot polish and got a sort of handful of this, nicely malleable, and with the help of my photographs, moulded my head. I had to go out for about an hour, and when I came back, something had happened to it. It had sort of sagged. And the face had gone sort of baboony and blubbery. And the clay and so on. So my wife said, the trouble is you've got a great lump of it. Why don't you do as you're doing pastry and fill it with dried peas, then put the thick top on, pinch it together as you do with pastry, and you've got the thing you can work on, and it won't sag. Which I did. And there it was. Photographs out. The toothpicks. Very good likeness. Into the oven. Well, we went to the pictures, because it would take about 4 or 5 hours to bake it hard. Anyway, by the time we got back, I reckoned the thing would either be a good terracotta image, or it would have slumped even more. Now, something had happened in the interim. What had happened was my son had popped in. You see, because he's working now, he's in gainful employment. He's working down a hole in just near the Tower Bridge, an archaeological dig. And he pops home as often as he can, once or twice a week, with pockets full of filthy washing, and stands up in the bath and scrapes off Thames mud from his salient features and eats whatever he can find in the house, as long as it's hot and smothered in chips, and disappears with a laconic note on the kitchen table. Well, when we came back from the pictures, I made for the oven, and my wife said, hello, Jamie's been home, and he's eaten. And she said, hello, that's funny. I don't remember leaving out. But that time I'd opened the oven door. It was empty. Suddenly a dreadful realisation dawns on me. I said, show me that note. By God, there it was in black and white. I knew what had happened now, so bang goes my posterity. Written on the note was, good pie, missed the chips.
It's nice to remember that, as far as I know, terracotta means cooked earth. I mean, it sort of fits in with the story. But we go on to Dennis Norden with his quotation, a time to be born and a time to die, which comes from the Bible in Ecclesiastes. Dennis.
The other day, I saw a woman's magazine article which posed
an interesting question. At what time of life do human relationships become most difficult? I thought, well, I can tell them what's the most difficult time for human relationships as far as the average middle-class male is concerned. It's that 20 minutes or so before your guests arrive when you're giving a dinner party. Now, I don't think any of you ladies listening have ever considered what that period is like for the host, for the man about the house. In the first place, everything is suddenly out of bounds. You get these warnings shouted at you from upstairs. Don't sit on the chairs, I've plumped all the cushions. Don't stand by the window, they'll think you're anxious. There's a pause, and then, where are you? I'm in the living room. On the carpet? No, not on the carpet. I am hanging by a crooked finger from the light. These long-range up-and-down conversations, by the way, they're another feature of this difficult 20 minutes. The reason for the to-and-fro shouting is that Madam insists on remaining upstairs until the very last moment. The thinking behind it, apparently, is that if she only puts her dress on when the doorbell rings, she avoids any possibility of premature creasing. You live with that. But you, however, sir, you lurk downstairs in this peculiar state of suspended animation. You see, you mustn't sit down, and there's nowhere you can stand up. Your whole domestic environment has become a sort of minefield. You know what I got once from upstairs? Did I hear ash dropping onto the rug? No, of course not. You're not dirtying a clean ashtray, I hope. No, not me. What are you doing with your ash? I'm swallowing it. So perhaps now you can understand why I classify that 20 minutes before the guests arrive as the most difficult time in all relationships. In fact, I now divide dinner parties into two distinct time periods. There's the actual eating period, and there's that period before it when all a man can do is just grin and bear it. In other words, a time to be born and a time to dine.
Well, that's an end to the English dinner party. And Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, and he and Dillis Powell, just by a whisker, win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.